Hello, and welcome to the CG Garage podcast, brought to you by the Chaos Group. This is episode 4, featuring Vlado. If you don't know who Vlado is, well, then I don't really know why you're listening to this podcast, because he's kind of an important part of it. But anyway, Vlado happened to be in Los Angeles, and he was here to talk about a bunch of stuff, so I figured it'd be a good opportunity for us to sit down with him. He's a very quiet guy, a really smart guy, and I really appreciate that about him, but he's got some amazing insights. So I want to talk to him about the history of V-Ray. He talks about that. He talks about bias versus unbiased, different types of new technology coming out, stuff that he's done, stuff that other people has done. So it's really interesting. So please let us know what you think. Please share and put your comments out there. We also happen to have a Twitter account. So if you want to share with that, it is @CG_labs or @CG_labs. And let us know what you think on there as well. All right. Thanks, guys. Hopefully you'll enjoy it.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So Vlado, we know the history of V-Ray is that basically you and Peter met in university, and he approached you to say, yep, "Hey, let's make start a company together," and you said no. And then 14 years later, we made V-Ray 3.0, right?
Yep.
So fast forward. So that's kind of a – I mean, I don't want to go through that history because I think it's an interesting one. But you over the last 14 years or 15 years or how long it's been, it's probably more than that since you've met Peter, right? I mean, it's been like
– Yeah, 97 till now is –
Yeah, it's a lot.
Quite a lot.
Yeah,
yes,
so
a long
17 years. Well, yes. Actually, no, I saw Peter said it's 17 years since he started Chaos Group. So that's a big deal. So since that time, I mean, you've spent a lot of energy looking at rendering engines and understanding what rendering is about, right?
Hopefully. Probably.
Just a little bit of time.
So it's, I mean, it's obviously a passion of yours, and it's a very, we were just discussing about the fact that people are so passionate about rendering engines more than anything in 3D. I think it seems to be like the most debated subject and really sort of puts you in a class. I mean, it's even worse than iPhone versus Android or anything else in some
or
cases.
Maya versus Max.
Mac versus PC is like...
you still think that's a gold standard of rivalries?
Yeah.
Of
probably,
rivalries?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's close, though.
It is close, yeah. So with that, where do you think that rendering has changed in the last 14 years, 15 years, whatever?
Many things. Well, the most important things that change is the hardware. When we started with V-Ray so many years ago, machines were horribly slow compared to what we have today. My phone is faster than the machines we had back then.
But we were still able to render, though.
Yes.
Right.
But you had to use different approaches. Like, you had to cheat a lot. You had to find ways to make things faster. And today, things are, of course, people always want to render faster, but now you can use algorithms that were unthinkable before. So you can brute force everything. You can trace a lot of rays, and an image will come out. Whereas before, you would have to wait many days for a brute force render to finish. Now it's minutes.
Okay. Well, this brings up an interesting paradigm then, because there's always been this, also one of the classic debates that goes on between rendering engine is biased versus unbiased, right? So brute force rendering is basically the idea behind unbiased in a lot of ways, right?
Well, there, I mean, the term unbiased has been misused in so many ways.
Okay.
Now, what it basically means from a mathematical point of view is that the render engine gives you, given enough time, gives you the correct result for your image. And it also means that if you make 100 renders of the same image and you combine them together, you will still get the correct result. Actually, very, very few of today's render engines are really unbiased in that sense.
Okay.
To be honest, I don't think there's any single one that actually is.
Okay.
But what people have come to associate unbiased rendering with is that you don't get any you don't use any interpolation, so you don't use things like irradiance caching or any kind light pre-cache or whatever
pre-computing type things.
Yeah. Right? So in that sense, people have grown accustomed to unbiased rendering to mean just sort of brute force rendering for everything.
Right.
And also there's a tendency to associate unbiased rendering with progressive renders.
Okay.
Which is kind of, I mean, most unbiased engines are progressive, but the two aren't
that's
really...
Not the, that doesn't mean it's the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, V-Ray can render unbiased and you can do it in buckets. So.
Right. And it can render progressive rendering with a biased
result. Yeah.
Whatever you want.
Yeah, you have options.
Yeah. So one thing is unbiased, but there's a lot of other things, like in 3.0, okay? So there's several things in 3.0 that are classically unbiased in a way, such as the secondary ray clamps. That's a very...
That's a very biased thing. Well, you know, also you have to make compromises. Like,
sure. That's not a compromise. I think that's a good thing because I think it's ultimately the artist doesn't want to say, I have two solutions to get rid of these specs on my thing.
Yeah,
one is to wait, wait 25 hours. And the second solution is to just clamp the secondary arrays and get the same result in 15 minutes.
That one, actually, one of the artists that worked for us suggested this idea so many years ago and bugged me about it for a long time.
Right.
And I was always like, I don't know if it's going to work. But we tried it eventually and it worked pretty well. So
that's another one. Another one that I like is the probabilistic lights.
Yep.
Because that's, again, a bias idea that you're for every bounce you're only collecting a certain sample of lights,
well,
right?
Actually, this is, I mean, the probabilistic lights are unbiased in the sense that they will give you the correct result after many samples eventually.
Sure.
So they're sort of they don't change the biasedness of the result,
right?
But they can help you get a result faster. And if you think they allow V-Ray to do other things in between all the light samples. So if you imagine that V-Ray has to trace a GI ray, then calculate all the lights for that ray, and then move on to the next ray, the probabilistic lights allow V-Ray to split the light evaluations in chunks and do other things in between them.
Right.
So you can get an image a lot faster.
Okay. Well, the clear result is that basically there's very unperceivable difference between it and not having it. But the render times are substantially higher. I mean, lower.
It can increase the noise in the image. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that if you're going to need a lot of image samples anyway,
right,
the result will be very close.
Right. I think it's really cool. Do you think eventually that things like Irradiance Map and Light Cache will fade away from the?
I would love them to.
Oh, really?
Because they're very finicky algorithms to get right, and they have all sorts of limitations. Like you get light leaks,
right,
flickering, and all
but
these.
But the light cache
issues.
Is such an amazing thing because you can get so many bounces of light out of that.
Yeah,
and so, I mean that's for the let's just call it the classic unbiased renderer, or what is known as an unbiased renderer suffers so much for. You know, when you need a lot of global nation, they really suffer and they'll do that.
Well, the light cache is a little bit, because it's somewhere in the middle between the two. I mean, it's a very interesting algorithm because it's calculated in a progressive way. And it, the fact that it can do a lot of mouses, as you said, is very nice. And it, this helps a lot, especially for interiors. If you have to do things like hair, it also helps for a volume rendering when you need to have light scattering inside a volume.
Right.
So that one will probably stay around for a bit longer. But the radiance map is, it can get you fast results, especially for fly-throughs. But again, like I told you, it has limitations.
I think people still like baking out the radiance map for a lot of those things. It's like you
said. It makes sense, especially if you want to reduce your render times. If you're rendering a huge landscape.
Right.
Yes, it's a bit maybe a little bit more difficult to set up, but eventually you do win a lot of render time.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So what are some of the other things that you're really proud of in terms of what you've done in 3.0? Like, what are the things? I mean, because I know this has been a sort of a almost like one of your most passionate ones that you've been working on in a way.
The biggest thing that we did, one was getting the progressive render working properly.
Okay.
Because it required a lot of changes in V-Ray. We had to make it work with render elements. We had to make it work with distributed rendering.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things took a while to get right. And also it enabled us in V-Ray for Maya to basically make the V-Ray RT engine to be the same as the production render on the CPU. So everything that before we had this separate shading pipeline for RT on the CPU, and the idea was that people would use the RT mostly for preview purposes. But at some point we realized that it would be very difficult to get the two to match. And it makes sense because we had to basically support two versions of the same thing. So we decided we should just get rid of the specialized RT pipeline, make everything work with the production V-Ray and just try and optimize that.
So basically progressive rendering is the evolution of RT into a progressive production renderer.
Yes.
So, but people are starting to, the thing I think that still becomes interesting is that people still consider RT as just for look development or just whatever. But some people are using RT to create final images in a way.
Yep.
So
that's true.
So, I mean, so it is a little bit different in a sense that I think that whole idea of progressive or just making the image is going to be different at this point, because now you can do proper motion blur, you can do proper depth of field,
render channels and all that stuff. Yeah.
So now it's like, you know, construct, we're running RT. There's no choice there. If you want to do it on a GPU, you got to render it on RT.
Yeah.
So, and that's working, obviously. Kevin's doing a really good job. And I think the changes that have happened in RT and in GPU rendering now, because I've been so involved with it, I gotta say, it's very hard for me to use a GPU anymore. When I have to, I do, but I just feel so slow. It's like, oh, what do you mean this render is going to take 40 minutes? That's like, I'm used to 25 seconds or 30 seconds. But I do I do happen to have access to a VCA, which it does help a little bit. having 8K 6000s rendering an image is a lot faster than.
Yeah. But especially now for the new service pack, when we have the light cache working on the GPU, we have a lot of other more textures. And it basically gets to a point where the GPU is a fully capable production renderer. And it has some limitations, that's true. But people have a choice. Either you can get a very fast render and give up maybe a little bit of features, or you can have everything, but render it slower on the CPU.
Or you can basically do all of your quick renders on your GPUs, and then if you need a lot more, you can just backburner that on the CPUs.
Choices are good.
Well, having
options is good.
Yeah, I mean, well, just the fact that it's not it's one or the other, and you use the same stuff, right?
Yeah,
you don't have to completely change your scene to switch from GPU to CPU.
It's that's Yeah, that's the nice thing about V-Ray is that you get practically any rendering technology that you might want to use. We probably have it, which is, on the one hand, it's very nice. On the other hand, it's a problem for us because we have too many things that it's sometimes confusing.
Well, too many choices. That's kind of one of the things that I've always noticed about, whenever we ask Vlado over the years, you guys say, "Hey, Vlado, can you do this?" Like, "Yeah, I could probably do this," and you just put it in there. So
that's my problem. I don't know how to say no.
Right? You don't know how to say no, right? So now there's a lot of things in there, like random. Like, why is this in here? It's like, well, someone asked for me for this 6 years ago, and there's this setting here.
We are at a point where we have to revisit some of those things that we've done a long time ago, and maybe try to either hide them or
turn them into a legacy of some kind. Yeah. Well, there's got to be a way to make some of that. And like you said, some of those requests came from 6, 7, 8 years ago, where the technology has changed so much that they're irrelevant. It's nice
to keep all of that around.
Yeah. But it has been around for a while, and you guys have, I'm part of the team now. we have supported a bunch of different industries and a bunch of different technology. Yep. And so it's been what I've always. Some people say, "Well, it's you're this way or that way." I remember a classic argument that I used at a company I used to work with. I'm not going to name names, but at a company I used to work with, where someone was basically looking at me and saying, "Well, V-Ray is very nice, but it's primarily for architects, and then that's not what we do." And I said, "That's such a wrong idea." And at the same time, I remember specifically that visual effects was catching up to architecture in terms of their knowledge of what true global illumination was. And architects did not realize that they knew way more about lighting than visual effects people actually did. They really knew about lighting way more because everyone's like, "Oh, no. Yeah, I know." I mean, my classic joke is that, they just used ambient occlusion and they called it GI, and that's not true GI. Yeah. If you ask an architect, like, that's not how light bounces. You can't just make dark corners and call it. That just doesn't work that way.
Ambient occlusion.
I know. It was just such. I didn't like it, and it's such a bunch of bullshit. But there was some really kind of interesting things about how V-Ray. One of the reasons it became popular over the years is because it was very good at doing GI and the architecture community, and not only good at it, but in an easy way. Because I remember there was lots of rendering engines. We've talked about the phases of the render battles over the years, right?
Yes.
So the phases of the render battles over the years, one was, when you first came out, there was the Maxwells and the Brazil. Not Maxwell, that's phase two, actually. So there was more of the Brazils and Final Render. That was the big three-way battle that was happening. But I remember using Final Render, and it was good, but to get your GI, it's probably changed a lot, so I'm sure Final Render has changed, but to get your GI right was so complicated at the time. It just, every image took incredible tweaking to get it right. And in V-Ray, it's like, here you go, preset, high, medium, low, and you're done. And that was revolutionary to an architect in a lot of ways. So I think that was, and because you made it so accessible, people started using it a lot more and they started to understand it. They weren't faking lighting. They were using it for actual light studies.
Yeah.
And I think it was really kind of cool. And then when I went to visual effects and they had no idea what I was talking about in terms of real GI. And now they're finally just using real GI. And I think that's something that I think that is really cool, because they would never have, if it wasn't for the knowledge base that you guys had done for the architecture community, there's a benefit now that you can get for the other community as well.
It's also interesting that in terms of amount of geometry in the scene, the ArcVis guys are used to rendering a lot more geometry than probably at some point the VFX guys, because they started doing, at some point, when machines started having everything moved to 64-bit.
But when they were still on 32-bit at the time.
But there was when things moved to 64-bit, there was a change in that people were able to do slightly more complicated scenes. So they used to load all these trees, grass, fields, everything And it's sometimes funny because you see a house in the middle of a whole landscape, and the house is like 1/10 of all the geometry in the scene.
Right.
Other things. And we did a lot of things in V-Ray to make this easier.
Right.
And it turned out that actually the ArcVis guys rendered, on average, much heavier scenes than VFX guys.
Really?
That's pretty interesting, actually.
Geometry-wise.
Geometry-wise,
yeah. Yes. But now and think that what's happened with the wonderful adaptation that the community has had with Mari, that the texture data that's going into rendering has gotten out of control.
So easy to generate just gigabytes and gigabytes of
way too
textures.
Easy.
Way too easy. And so this is an interesting, like, obviously V-Ray has kind of done a lot over the years to help that with the different ways of mitmapping and other things that are going on. But I mean, what do you see think is going to be the future of dealing with that much texture data?
To be honest,
more RAM, is that really a solution? Or?
I was hoping at some point that PTEX is going to be more popular.
Does PTEX use less RAM?
It tends to, because it's a plus and a minus, right? It's tied to the geometry, so you don't have, like, when you do texture maps, because of all the UV unwrapping, you get parts of the UV space that are not really used. So you get parts of the textures that are not used. So this eats up a little bit of RAM.
So it's more efficient in making sure that all the RAM that's needed is used, and all the texture space that's needed is used.
Yeah, so that was a hope that didn't quite materialized,
right?
But I don't know. There, besides PTEX, there really haven't been any other ideas how to reduce the number of textures or the amount of textures with the shading detail. So I don't know really.
Well, we talked briefly, and then this obviously is a completely different technology, and we can talk more about it. But obviously, we're talking about the new rendering engine that they're doing at Disney, is Hyperion, is that what it's called?
Yep.
So that approaches it very differently. So you can put a lot more texture data into a system like that. So let's just to get people up to date, why don't you give us your description of what that rendering engine is, or that technology is?
All right. it uses an idea that it's been around for a long time, but it it's been implemented, I think, several times since then, but not in the renderer that's used by a major studio.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, you generate many rays. Like, you generate all the primary rays for your image, and then you trace all those rays, then you generate all the secondary rays for GI and for reflections and so on. So in a normal ray tracer, you do the rays one by one recursively. So you start with one ray from the camera, you trace it through the scene, calculate it, put it back on the image.
Mm-hmm.
With Hyperion, they do this for very large batches of rays.
Mm-hmm.
And because you have so many rays, you can sort them and organize the shading calculate organize the rays in such a way that the shading calculations are done on points in the scene that are close to each other, so you can use texture caches much more efficiently.
Okay.
With a renderer like V-Ray, when you have GI rays flying all over the scene, it may end up that just in a single bucket you need to load a very large amount of textures. And for the next bucket, you might have to throw all these away and load a whole bunch of different textures.
Right.
With Hyperion, it's all a lot more ordered.
Okay.
So you can go through the geometry and the textures in a more efficient way. And it does really help you to render lots of geometry and lots of textures. And it's a plus. But it also has a limitations. Like, some things are very difficult to do. So if you want to trace some rays and do something with the results afterwards, it'll be very big. You have no way of going back. You can just go forward in the scene and generate the first bounce, secondary bounce, and so on, but you can't go back to the first bounce and do something after it's been traced.
Okay.
And some effects really require this capability. So they're going
like
to be
give me an example of something.
An example. Ambient occlusion could be an example.
Really? you can't do ambient occlusion.
Yeah. But sometimes people want to take the ambient occlusion value and use it in calculations, like multiply other colors by the ambient occlusion factor or whatever.
Okay.
You don't have to use it to fake GI. You may use it for other effects.
Right.
But the fact that you need to trace a bunch of rays and get the results back together and do something, it's easy in a normal render, in a normal recursive render. It's not so easy with the approach that the Hyperion guys have taken.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways around it, of course, but it gets more complicated.
Okay.
The other thing is that because you're generating all these millions of rays, you have to store them somewhere. In their system, they're using the fact that they have fast SSD drives to store those rays to disk.
Right.
And they mentioned that the information they need to store for one single ray, it was very compact, something like, I don't know, 660 or 64 bytes or something
mm-hmm.
like this. But I'm comparing this to a normal ray state for V-Ray, which is, and I'm here, I'm using V-Ray GPU, which is really also optimized and compact.
Right.
And V-Ray GPU uses about 300 bytes for a ray state.
As opposed to 64K.
Yeah. But because we need to store a lot of, just because to do all the shading that V-Ray supports, we need to have this additional information about the rays. So some interesting features just require more storage. And as the storage requirements increase, it becomes more and more difficult to follow that approach.
Right. But I mean, one of the things you're also saying is that think about it in a situation like Disney and what type of feature animation they're trying to do.
Yeah, it will probably work out very well for them.
Right, because they're doing massive scenes,
yes.
Lots of information.
Yeah.
And the more complex the scene, the better the efficiency of that renderer is, right?
But on the other, there's also, on the other hand, implementing things like bidirectional path tracing would be very difficult.
Right, because it can't go back.
Yes. And with V-Ray, it's easy because you can do all kinds of things. Like it's,
right.
And we have a bidirectional path tracer in V-Ray.
Right.
Which does need more work, but it's there.
Right.
With Hyperion, you'll basically have to rewrite the whole thing from scratch if you wanted to do that.
Okay.
I guess they're catering it to their needs.
Yes.
So.
Well, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I just finished reading the Creativity Inc. book, right? And then there was this been discussion about like why would Disney ever make a new rendering engine? Ed Catmull is the president of Disney, and he pretty much invented RenderMan. Why doesn't he just continue making RenderMan? And everyone's like, oh, well, they're just trying to kill off RenderMan. I don't think that's true either, to be honest. I actually think Ed Catmull's philosophy, after reading his book, now there may be some BS in there, but to be honest, he sounds very much like a really upfront guy and very respected. But I really think that he wanted to go in to Disney and not make it Pixar. Wanted to make two different experiments in a way of how a good company can be run. And he's doing a really good job at Disney. The quality of the material coming out of Disney since him and John Lasseter has come out is obviously now rivaling their own company in a non-competitive way. Let's just put it that way. But I really think that he wanted to go in there. He's like, you know what? If I'm going to start from scratch, I might as well do a new rendering engine too and do something different.
Yeah, it's like doing something from scratch always gives you the chance to do things differently, slightly differently.
Right.
And maybe it will come out better than it was before.
If you were to write V-Ray from scratch now, I'm sure you've thought about it. But if you were to write V-Ray from scratch today, where would you put your focus on? What would be your thing?
I would probably first start by, and we're kind of doing bits and pieces of that, but I would really try to do different approaches first and see which one works better. And we've had a few experimental ray tracers that we've done just to see what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. There are a bunch of different approaches that can be taken. And to be honest, I don't know if I had to start from scratch, which one I would.
So you'd want to just start experimenting from the beginning.
Basically,
so,
yeah.
And you, well, there's, I mean, you still have the chance to do that in a lot of ways, but it'd be hard for you.
Well, it sounds like you are. You said you did have a few,
a few experimental. But starting just throwing all that work away and starting from scratch is not an option because there's just so many things in VRA that it will take many years to rewrite the whole thing.
Sure. Yeah.
So, we're probably just looking at ways to take that research that we've done and slowly change the core of UA to work in a different way.
Okay.
Without throwing.
But you guys did a lot, and you can talk about this briefly, but I mean, you guys did a lot in V-Ray 3.0 towards in the core of V-Ray, right?
Yes. And actually, there's one part of V-Ray that I'm very proud of because the architect. I didn't realize, of course, this back then, but the architecture is such that you can change all the things in V-Ray without having to rewrite everything. So we've been able to do things like implement Embry in V-Ray. Embry is a whole new Ray cluster engine by Intel. It's very highly optimized for CPUs. It works really well. They recently added support for Hair. They're working on a bunch of other primitives, and it was not very difficult for us to replace or not replace it. We've still kept our own code around for various reasons, but it was very easy to take this library and integrate it into V-Ray and get the performance boost out of that
without having to
rewrite anything else.
Yeah.
And it's true for a lot of things. Like we managed to implement bidirectional path tracing engine for V-Ray again without, well, we've had to make changes here and there, but it hasn't been like a total rewrite. We've been able to use more or less the same architecture. And also many times during the development of V-Ray, we've had requests to add specific features to shaders or geometry, and we've been able to implement these without breaking things in a major way. So
it's probably why there's so much stuff.
Yes. That's partly the reason. Yes. Yeah. And of course that means that things are probably not implemented always in the most efficient way because we kind of left the code more general than it probably should be.
Right.
But you can replace a lot of things in V-Ray and I'm hoping that we can gradually start moving it in a different direction.
Yeah. Well, let's talk quickly about the idea of strange requests. I remember when I first started at the company about a year ago, and we got a request from Kevin Margo that he said he wanted to run V-Ray inside of Motion Builder, which just sounds like, to me, it sounds like I want to run V-Ray inside of Angry Birds. You know, like it just like
can I put it on my phone?
It's like why do you need V-Ray inside of Motion Builder? Because I never thought of V-Ray rendering at that speed, so I never thought of V-Ray as the real time being like almost literally real time ray tracing. I always thought it's like, you know, it's the render; it needs time. You got to finish the render. You can't just do that. So that was a very strange request, and I think you probably like, oh, okay, we can try it. This.
Yeah.
Challenge accepted.
Yes. But yeah, with a lot of things, when people ask, can you do this? And many times I don't really know.
Right.
But I would say yes, and I will figure it out afterwards.
Right.
Which is, I don't know if it's a good habit or a bad one.
Right.
But in this case, it was a... So when we started this, I didn't even know if it's possible to get the data out of Motion Builder. I didn't know whether you can do custom rendering inside of Motion Builder at all. But we got one of the guys, Nicola, to look into that. And it was because Motion Builder supports Python. Mm-hmm. And we have the Vray App SDK, which is a layer on top of the regular Vray engine that has a Python binding.
Yep.
And it allows you to do integrations with other things, with other applications very easily. So we thought it would be a good test for that. And we decided just to see where the whole thing will go. And we did have... so we got the basic rendering working.
Yeah.
But it was too slow. It was like 2 frames a second or something.
Right. Well, you just got it in there. Yeah. So yeah, you didn't know... But you were just using V-Ray kind of the way it was. And it's
So Nicola had to sit down with the profiler and figure out ways to make the whole thing run more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very unusual situation for V-Ray because it's typically been an offline render engine where you have time to prepare the scene and do stuff.
Right.
And then the final image. With RT, things are a little different because you can change things in the scene while V-Ray is rendering.
Mm-hmm.
But it still needed time to do that. We haven't imagined V-Ray running at 20 or 30 frames per second.
that's very short time to update your scene.
That's the dream.
Yes. But it turned out that, well, we were lucky because the general structure of the code was not terrible.
Okay.
Like, we had bottlenecks and we had problems, but they were just because we haven't really spent time to optimize them.
Yeah.
So we were able eventually, Nicole was able to get the update times to be really, really low. We were also very lucky that Kevin's scenes only involved rigid bodies. Like there was no...
There's no deformation.
Right.
Mm.
This was...
we're going to get to that, though.
Yeah.
I can see that being requested next.
Well, yes. It's going to be requested. Yes. It's going to be. If anyone gets started on it,
and
it's like
we
this.
Are, we're looking into that.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, that was a lucky coincidence for us. And we were able to get the whole thing running at up to 30 frames per second.
Yeah.
With the appropriate hardware.
So, with the appropriate hardware is an important part of the cha-ching. Yeah. Well, the thing is, okay, so that was a thing. To be honest, like it was more like a proof of concept, right? Like, can we actually get this to do? It was more like challenge accepted. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And so it was, they were doing it. And so like, huh. And then I remember Kevin, I was like, this is so cool. And I made a little video out there of us doing this literally just one day with a 5D and just the microphone on the 5D, no boom mic or anything else, just literally just 5D on there. Crappy sound, trust me, because I had to try to fix it. And I told Kevin, it's like, I told Brian, our editor, I was like, we need this a video out real quick because we're going to go to do this presentation. He did that whole edit in like 8 hours just to try to figure out how to do it. I emergency called my composer, Alex. Like, I just need something. He's like, maybe a little piano music, something a little dramatic, but piano music, just make something fun or whatever. Did that, banged it out in like half a day, got it all out. And it's one of the most popular videos we have on YouTube. And it even got featured on Engadget, and it got featured on Wired and all these different places.
That's cool.
And it is really cool because then suddenly it's just, we had no idea in a way that people would be interested in this. We just didn't.
Well, we still don't know whether they will be really. It's right, like a curiosity. Like
it is a curiosity, but it is and it isn't, because I think what it did is, especially if you put it in the hands of someone like a Kevin or whoever is familiar with that process and that pipeline of motion capture. Daniel and I, as an example, we're lighters. We're like, whatever, we just get it from animation and we'll light it for you, right? But if you're from that process of like understanding where the animation is coming from, being involved in motion capture, that is just mind-blowing to a lot of people. And that's the dream in a lot of ways. That's the dream, because now you're suddenly dealing with the same assets the whole way. And I think that's something that I think people want to do, is they want to be able to use the same thing across there. So why not introduce rendering way earlier in the process? Yep. And I think that's something that I think would be really, really interesting to sort of see where that's going to go. I never Yeah, I was like you, Plato, and I'm an artist too, and I've been involved in production, and I'd never thought that something like that would happen. So it's cool to see that, and I think that what we're doing in this lab is going to be interesting. I remember before we were going to SIGGRAPH, and we had a small makeshift motion capture stage that we set up in the lab so we can test the V-Ray on Motion Builder. And I looked at Vlado and I said, so Vlado, did you ever think that we'd be setting up a motion capture stage to test your rendering engine? And it was like, nope, I don't think I would have ever thought to do that. So I think it's interesting. And there's been a lot of requests to see where this technology is going. I like it. I think it's cool. And I think the fact that we have V-Ray running in Motion Builder and we have V-Ray running in Nuke means that you've pretty much start to finish working in V-Ray in a lot of ways. So I think that's a good thing. And I think it helps everyone in the end. What do you think about some of these weird experiments that we're doing? What do you think would be interesting? Do you have any ideas that you want to do?
I was going to ask the same thing.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There are many things that I want to try, but I'm really more on the technique. Like, I like to play with a V-Ray core and change stuff there. So
you really want to dig down into the engine in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Anything specific you want to change or experiment with or what? If you can say.
There's so many things. Like Chris mentioned the problem with lots of textures in Mari. And the way we do it now is good and it does the job. But I think there are better ways to do it. And we need to do some research related to that.
Right.
The same thing with the heavy geometry rendering. V-Ray can handle many, many scenes. It was actually very funny that we had somebody on the forum trying to render scan data of something. I don't know what it was.
Right.
It was like 600 million triangles.
Wow.
Unique triangles.
Right.
He came across some problems that with the V-Ray proxies that we had to fix for him. But eventually he was like, yeah, I'm rendering 600 million polygons and the images for 40,000 by 30,000 or something, and it's all going. Each frame is taking 15 minutes, which is great.
Nice,
really?
I was like, yeah,
nice.
600 million polygons,
yep.
And how big was the image?
Was like 40,000 by 30,000 or something. Jeez. It was huge.
Wow,
and
wow,
what could that be used for? That's huge.
I have no idea what it was about, but it was a fun thing. But so that works and works pretty well, but it can be done better.
Right.
And it's one topic of research that I want to do. The real-time handling of deforming meshes is also something that we're looking at, which is going to be a very interesting
right
thing to handle.
Right.
With so far.
Well, here's another problem as an example, right, that I'd never thought to come across. Like I said, we've been rendering on the VCA. And we're doing some of these things for Construct, and some of the renders are taking all in all take probably about 5-6 minutes a frame, right?
Yeah.
Normally, that render on a CPU, on a dual CPU, so 32 cores or whatever, that takes about 3.5 hours to render. As opposed to 6 minutes on the VCA. And that's exactly what it is. The problem is a little over 2 minutes of that time is just loading the scene.
Yes.
So you've lost efficiency in V-Ray.
Yeah.
Well, 2.5 minutes to load a scene was nothing when your render was was 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
So now how can we take that 2.5 minutes and reduce it down?
Percentage-wise,
it's almost half your time.
Yeah, that's also something that we've looked at, and it's getting better. But again, it's something that we've never anticipated that will be a problem.
Right. It was like 2.5 minutes to load a scene should not be a problem.
Yeah.
But now it is. Yes. So,
well,
so
that's change, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So it was almost like, you know, there's got to be like, you know, just thinking about what you just mentioned before about Motion Builder, you're somehow loading in or change states or data much faster. So maybe that will carry through in some of the load times. But anyway, it's really, really interesting to sort of get like these are good problems to have. Let's just put it that way. So when your renders are too fast, that your load
makes
time,
everything else look slow.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, eventually if people are starting to adapt GPU rendering, there's going to land into a texture problem as well. They can't do what they're doing in texture.
Well, and you had to do some very non-traditional networking to get that to work too, huh?
Well, we're... Yes.
Or not non-traditional, but non-standard.
As far as textures are concerned, we've actually implemented out-of-core texture rendering for the GPU. And it's not too bad. It's slower than if you don't do it. But it still works, and you can render a huge amount of textures. You can use UDIMMs, whatever you can use these on the GPU. And programming for the GPU is difficult. Like, you have to find ways to express an algorithm like ray tracing in a very untraditional way.
Okay.
Put it this way.
But V-Ray on GPU and V-Ray on CPU is literally just two different V-Rays completely,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So what I think is interesting is like, you know, it's like, oh, well, we're a rendering engine, but it's GPU only, and we're a great rendering, but CPU only. V-Ray literally has just literally two rendering engines, but they just happen to take the same data.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah. So that's what's interesting about it to me is
that, and that's
to the user, it's invisible, right?
Well, no, I mean, the problem is that we have things on the GPU that GPU cannot handle all the shading networks from the CPU, and we've got this problem where people we'll take an existing scene, try to put it on the GPU, and it doesn't work for whatever reason because they used some strange procedural texture or something like that. And this led to a lot of people saying, yeah, I won't ever use GPUs because my scene looks different. And that's true. But if you start a new scene from scratch for the GPU and with the GPU in mind, you don't see all these discrepancies.
Right, you don't just...
You can still be a happy user.
Sure, sure. I mean, I was dealing with that when I was over at one of our clients and they were doing stuff and I was like, wait, this doesn't look at all the same. And I realized like, oh, well, dirt shaders use, and that was not implemented yet at the time. And so I was like...
Oh, taking old scenes.
It's getting better. Okay. We're adding more and more stuff. But there's always going to be that...
That one thing.
Yeah, one thing. But the way I look at it, you can either take it or leave it. You can have a very fast render. Well, it won't do some things, but you can still get an image out of it.
Right.
Or you can choose to ignore it, and then you will render things slower, but you will be happy that you have all the features that you want.
Right. But again, like you said, every time, you know, someone says, well, you know, it doesn't do hair. Well, now it does hair. You know, it's every time it's like, yes. I won't do skin. Well, now it does skin. Yes. And so, yeah, it doesn't.
Where's the render elements? Oh, there they are. Yeah.
We wouldn't be having all these issues if we had just GPU render, because people wouldn't have anything to compare it to.
Yeah. But we can thank people like Mike Romy for making sure that the big list of requests of all GPU technology is available. And so those things have been happening. So, yeah, Mike Romy is one of our customers we've been working with for a while. He's at Zoic, and he's been very, very strong in terms of trying to push GPU technology in their studio. And
they do some amazing stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they need a lot of renders really fast. You know, since they do 800 shots a week or something.
Yeah, it's mind blowing.
And so they basically are like, well, I need a lot of textures, so, or I need this, I need that. Their feature request was huge. And there was a big thing that we did at a GTC that you talked about how we manage feature requests, which actually was pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, we're getting even closer now. We got displacement subdivision surfaces in the GPU.
Right.
Hair is already there. There are a few other, the light cache, which was a major thing.
Right. So now people can do some serious GI. It's the thing people still think of. I mean, that's the thing, right? I think people still think of GPU as like it's only for look development.
You know, and because by some kind of coincidence, most of the GPU renderers out there are just pure path tracers.
Right.
So you do get an image quickly and they can trace all arrays very quickly. But because it's brute force, it still takes longer to render than a CPU using the light cache, for example.
Right.
But now when we have the light cache, you can get actually usable scenes out of the GPU in a really...
In a fraction of the time, yeah. I mean, I remember the, like the demo of that train station scene that uses the light cache in there. I can on the VCA, granted it's VCA and it's very, but it is a complex scene with light cache, and I can move around at like five frames a second.
It makes the GPU, VRA GPU, really useful for architecture and for interiors and all that interesting stuff.
Yeah, because you can't. Again, it's the those interior scenes are going to become your challenge for
true. Yeah, if you try brute forcing. They will render just in a very long time.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, just ask anyone who's tried to do it, a so-claimed unbiased render to try to do a complicated interior scene. It just takes a long time.
Yeah, it does.
So what are some of the favorite projects that you've seen that have come out the last few years that you like, that you've been very happy about?
It's difficult to figure out because I only see the problems in all the projects because we only get the bug reports and the issues, like, and there's always things to do. So it's sometimes hard to look back and say, well, I like how this turned out.
But apparently you're also getting to the point now where you don't realize how many things are actually done in V-Ray, like someone told you.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. And you didn't know that Maze Runner was done in
No, in, yeah. I didn't know until the movie was out and I saw it and I was wondering, I wonder what that was done.
Yeah, it was done with
That's going to make you feel kind of happy. I mean,
yes.
Yeah, that's my render engine.
Yeah, yes, seen by millions of people.
Yeah. That's kind of a good feeling to understand or see that happens. So I enjoy that. But at the same time, you know, I've been working on movies for a while. So, like, I'm just like Vlado, and I see only the problems now. When I go to a movie that I've worked on, it's like going to dailies for 2 hours, and I always is like, oh, I still got that glint in that hair. It looks like crap, you know. Or it's just you've completely lost the plot. You know, I have no idea.
Or you just don't want to see it.
Like, or you just don't want to see it.
I'm tired of seeing that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's several movies that I've worked on that I've never seen for good reason. Like, I've never seen Ghost Rider, and I've worked on that for like 9 months, right? I've never seen 47 Ronin. Did you ever? You worked on 47 Ronin for
a while. Yeah, for a while. And it eventually did come out, didn't it?
Yeah, I didn't. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
You see? There you go.
Well, I don't go watch movies, though.
You don't see movies. Yeah. You don't go to daily sometimes.
Shh. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I actually had.
It doesn't matter anymore.
No, well. No, I had one more question about hardware. You had mentioned that when people change from 32-bit to 64-bit, mm-hmm. you know, obviously you gain the possibility of using more RAM. So that was a huge burden lifted.
Yes.
From the shoulders of anybody trying to render anything remotely complex. What's the kind of the burden right now on hardware?
Memory is never enough. Like, even though we have 64.
The same burden?
Yes, it's getting better. And I've seen like people do crazy things. Like people would open millions of scenes that have millions of triangles and they would open them in max. It takes a while, but it works eventually. But the problem with things like Max and Maya is that you load the entire scene in Max, and it already takes most of your RAM.
So right.
There's actually very little amount of RAM left for V-Ray to do anything with that scene.
Right.
And especially with 32-bit, it was a horrible problem because you would open a scene, it would take 1 gigabyte, and V-Ray would be left with only like a few hundred megabytes.
That's the thing that I just don't understand. There's a lot of people that are like, oh, no, I just render straight batch render out of Maya or whatever. I said, why don't you just render in V-Ray standalone? Because you're basically loading your scene twice.
Yeah, close Maya.
For 3ds Max specifically, because back in the days of 32-bit machines, we had to make sure that we use as much data from 3ds Max directly and we don't duplicate anything that doesn't really need to be duplicated.
Okay.
So Vray can be quite efficient at that, but it still needs some memory.
Right.
But yeah, the best way to keep memory usage low is just to render with Vray standalone, because right. we only load things that we need for the render. We don't. The modeling applications need a lot of memory to make sure that you can edit the scene in an efficient way.
Right.
Which you don't really need to keep around when you render the scene.
Gotcha.
So the other thing is always speed. Like, people always like faster renders.
Right.
Memory and processor. Still the same.
So obviously we talked about GPU. And we talked about, you know, well, that's been years. But now I mean, we're going to studios nowadays. Where I mean, you and I visited several studios. We're doing bug reports. All these machines now, they get like 48 cores, 128 gigs of RAM. I mean, just crazy amount of stuff that I would just like just yep. seems impossible.
It's still not enough.
it's still not enough.
No, it is. The thing is, how is it that we can't be more efficient? I think that just people get lazy.
Well, yeah, we're not as efficient.
Stuff in the scene, like before you could only render one building, now you want to do the whole city block.
Yeah.
Or you just render the house, now you want to render everything around it, the trees, grass, roads, cars.
I mean, I used to delete polygons per shot because it wouldn't render unless I did that. Right. Now you just leave it there and then just hit render. Yeah.
Right.
Then yeah, I mean, I think
that's what I've been
mentally about. not as efficient on how you set up scenes.
Yeah.
And it's catching up with us now.
And I think the texture stuff is too. You know, people's like, oh yeah, we'll just get all this texture detail and just sit there and marring or painting and suddenly it's like
something that will be like 5 miles away.
And the character has like, you know, 4,000 texture maps on it, and that's insane.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot. So yeah.
Yeah. We have to render it anyway.
Yeah. So. Well, you do, and you're not going to change people's mind. You can't tell people to stop the way that they want to do things, right? Yeah. So it's now just become a new interesting challenge to deal with.
Oh, yep. As fast as the machines get, we're just going to throw more at it.
Well, they're not getting that much faster anymore. Like, if it's not like in the beginning of the century where you got like processor speeds like doubled every year or something.
Right.
So it's not like that.
No, everything's kind of still around the 3 gigahertz.
Yeah, they keep adding more cores, but there's a limit to that. You can't. At some point, you start to lose efficiency. And there are very few cases where things can continue to scale linearly when you get into the hundreds of cores.
Right. Well, not with.
Well, GPUs are a different thing.
Right.
They have a totally different architecture from CPU. So
okay.
They can do that.
Right. So they scale way more linearly. And we've noticed that in a way. We just add twice the cards and we're getting twice the speed in a lot of ways. But that's a different thing. Again, there's all, like you said, there's limitations to GPU. There's limitations to how we implement it. There's limitations to RAM.
Yeah.
RAM is... You know, 12 gigs is far off the 128 gigs that people are asking for.
Yeah.
But it's still way better than the...
It's getting better.
Well, yeah, compared to... And it wasn't too long ago where 4 gigs was probably the most you could get on a video card, and that just wasn't going to cut it for most people. Yep. 12 gigs you can do a lot with.
Yep.
But still, there's a lot of people out there that are doing stuff with 128, you know? So, but I think it's interesting. Volumetric stuff is actually happening too, right? With some volume stuff.
Yeah. But we have kind of a similar problem. Like, we can brute force volumes on the GPU, and they're very fast compared to brute forcing them on the CPU. But because on the CPU, we've done all these other things to make rendering faster, like caching illumination.
Right.
And all sorts of hacks. And we can get a CPU render to be very fast for volumes. So if you want to... the GPUs to match all that, they have to be able to do that as well.
Right.
It's just brute forcing everything is simply not the fastest. I mean, the speed of the hardware can't compensate the slowness of the brute force.
Right? Exactly. Okay. That's interesting.
And it's more complicated with volumes, but it will get there.
Is there anything else besides rendering technology that you're passionate about on the software side of things that you find interesting?
I've actually done a bunch of other things. Well, it's always been around computer graphics, right?
Sure.
And rendering is the most obvious thing that you can do in that regard. But right. The other part is physical simulations. So I did a plugin way back.
Oh, SimCloth. Cloth.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's still around in people's.
It's open source, isn't it?
It's out there. Yeah. You can. Most of it is open source. There's a little bit that's not. But I should probably release that as well. It's not really anything complicated. There are much better cloth simulators out there now, obviously.
Sure.
It was just an experiment to see how things are done, basically.
Right.
I remember using it.
Nice. No, there's still people using it because it's very simple. It doesn't have any, well, like everything, it's a plus and a minus. But it can do like basic cloth stuff very easily.
So you've always had an interest in physicals. Yes. Well, ray tracing is almost
that's
a physical simulation.
That's why we keep the Phoenix project. We started it because we were interested in how fluid simulations are done.
Well, Phoenix has come a long way too in recent years.
And
sphere foam.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time on that. There was a lot of R&D involved into that. We only recently added a flip solver in the nightly builds for fluids, which is super cool. And you can do it's much more stable and you can get better results a lot faster.
What is a flip solver?
It's basically until now, Phoenix has been a grid simulator. Like everything is in a grid.
Yep.
The flip solver is still based on a grid, but it uses particles under the hood to transfer stuff inside the grid itself.
Okay.
So it's sort of hybrid between a particle simulator and a grid solver.
Mm-hmm.
And it can do liquids very, very efficiently.
Oh, so much faster simulation?
They're faster and more stable.
Hmm.
With a grid approach, it's difficult to, because the liquid does not really fit well into a grid. Like if you have water flowing down a very slight slope,
mm-hmm.
with a grid method, you will get this staircasing thing happening.
Right.
Which is difficult to get rid of. But when you use particles, it's very easy, obviously, because particles are
just
constrained
down,
to a grid. So, and not only that, all kinds of other things are also easier if you use particles. So that's kind of interesting. And we've also expanded Phoenix to be like a complete water simulation tool. You can have foam splashes. We have an infinite ocean plane.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been very, from a research standpoint, it's been very interesting for us to see how these things are done.
Yeah, I really love seeing the Phoenix stuff, and a lot of people are starting to use it.
And there was always people were asking, well, we have other software packages which are very, very good for all kinds of fluid things. Like Houdini is very good at that because it was basically made for this.
Mm-hmm.
This RealFlow, Naiad is now being integrated in Autodesk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, but sometimes we do things because they're interesting, you know, necessarily because they
fun
have to make
project.
Sense.
Yeah,
but I think it's interesting to keep going with it. Obviously, some people are using more people are using it every day, but I think it's also really interesting to see what's there and what's possible, and the fact that it's working directly with V-Ray is another thing that I think is also kind of cool.
Yeah.
So, It is an interesting project, and I like the way Phoenix works, and I love seeing some of that stuff happen. So is this the first time you've been on a podcast?
Yep.
how is it compared? You've done a bunch of interviews, which I know you don't always like doing interviews.
Yeah, I don't like doing interviews.
This podcast was easier.
Yeah.
Cool. So it's not too bad. I was thinking it pretty good. They're a little more casual. So we always do even though we've been talking about progressive rendering, what we always do when we end our podcast is say we're going to let the last bucket drop. Wait for the last bucket to drop. So that's what we're going to do, our sign off. So we're going to do that. So we're going to let the last bucket drop, and I'm going to actually, there you go. Thanks, guys.
And here it goes.